Hi, everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable, episode number 128. Today we'll be discussing Avatar The Legend of Korra Season 3, Episode 7, The Terror Within, and Episode 8, The Stakeout. If you would like to get in contact with us to tell us what we did wrong in this episode or make other, possibly more generous compliments, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can leave a comment on this post on hypeable.com. And you can also play with us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. So my name is Michal. I'll be your host for today. I'm joined by Ariana. I'm trying to do that. I really am. Mitch and Caitlin. So in our typical new thingy majiggy, we are starting off with fun facts. And Mitch said that he had a fun one. So let's start with you, Mitch.
I do. I have an awesome one. So last night, I know, shocker, watched Scott Pilgrim vs. the World for the first time.
Oh, great movie.
I've been told I always had to. And as y'all might know, it has a little tiny role for Mae Whitman. And also Audrey Plaza, so they are the voices of Katara, and it's Eska, right?
Yeah.
Or Desna.
The girl.
The girl, Eska.
So it's fun because there's one part when...
Who's Audrey Plaza?
I don't know, which one's the girl?
Eska, or Desna.
Okay.
No, I'm saying who is she in Scott Pilgrim?
She has the bleepy mouth when she's talking to him, and she's kind of like Envy's friend.
Okay.
Right. It's kind of a random role, but she still like has a lot more screen time than even Mae Whitman does. Because Mae Whitman is one of the evil exes that he has to fight.
So there's a fight scene. I definitely remember Mae Whitman in that movie.
She has
these
cute little like pigtails. And it's really awesome because she has like these grunts and these battle cries just like Katara. Like you can tell she's trying to talk normal. Like she's not trying to talk in her Katara voice, right? Because why would you? But I think when she goes into battle mode, like she automatically starts sounding like she's like trying to fight off like Azula or something. It's so amazing, and it made me so happy. And Audrey
That's
Plaza
funny.
Does sound so much like Eska. It's crazy.
That's because she only has one voice.
Yeah.
Because I don't really... what show is she on again that everyone loves? Community, I think?
Parks and Rec.
I don't really watch that show to know her on that, but I recognized her in this immediately just from her voice, like, as soon as she came on. It was so cool. It's almost worth watching it just for those two, just to be like, oh my god, this is like watching Korra.
It's also a good movie.
It is.
It's a weird movie, but it's a fun movie.
I described it as, you know, very jumpy and very ADD, so it's like you kind of have to be in that mode to watch it, because it feels like a comic book. But I think a lot of people that listen to this podcast would like it from that fact, because you have fight scenes like a comic book would be. And, I mean, Korra is even more mature than a comic book, but it's fun. I think anyone who wants to get into it, I mean, Anna Kendrick and Chris Evans are in it for little random roles, too. It's just the cutest little thing. I don't really know how to describe it.
Yeah, it's basically a what analogy did I? Oh, it's based on a comic book, which is basically based on an imaginary life as a video game. So mm-hmm. it's that's the tone.
Right.
Very cool. Caitlin, how about you?
Well, just going off the movie thing, I saw The Martian on Friday, so there's my fun fact.
Oh, was it good?
I enjoyed it.
Okay.
It's not quite as funny as the book, but I understand why things were cut just for time. But I enjoyed it quite a bit.
So, I mean, I thought that it was kind of weird that the cast was very similar to Interstellar's. Did that, like, stand out to you at all? Or is this the first time you noticed that, or...?
I haven't seen Interstellar, so...
Oh, okay. Because Matt Damon was also in that, as was Jessica Chastain. But I think she didn't have as big of a role, right?
She was the captain of the crew.
Oh, so
of
she
Matt
did.
Damon's crew.
That's just strange to me. I didn't understand that. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
Maybe they did such a good job. They were like, do it again.
You can like... Well, she wasn't in space in the movie. But like,
right.
You can act like you're in space. yeah, it was funny because how we hyped this week was basically everyone doing something with The Martian, which was funny. Ariana, how about you?
Same theme. Last night I watched Hotel Transylvania for the first time, and it was super cute.
Oh, the first one?
Yeah.
Because the second one just released and it like did awesome.
I
the
know.
Box office.
People
I was
amazed. Went crazy for it, so
I didn't even know it was a thing, but people like seemed to love it.
Yeah.
There has to be, like, one crossover of, like, an Atler or a Core actor.
It was Adam Sandler.
So I don't
doing think... a passable job as a trans Count Dracula accent.
And I have two fun facts, actually. One is that on a variation of this theme, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is back, so my life is complete. And also, just in case anyone was interested, there's a box set of Avatar The Last Airbender being released on Tuesday. I'll have a review that's probably going up on Tuesday also, but it is pretty much, like, the most extensive, like, I mean, it's got, like, a million commentaries, it's got, like, tons of behind-the-scenes stuff. I think they've released it in box set before, but I feel like this thing has just got every single thing in it, and it's not that expensive. I mean, on DVD on Amazon, it's, like, $30, so, yeah, I was like, I'm giving it a good review, and I haven't looked at it yet, but, like, I actually think it's, like, probably really worth it.
Awesome. The first series?
It's just Airbender, so it's okay. Books 1, 2, and 3, yeah.
Okay.
That's cheap. But, I mean, what?
That's cheap. $30
for this. I know, $30 for, I know, and like I said, tons of stuff on it. So I feel like if people are looking, I don't think it's available on Blu-ray, unfortunately, but that's probably why it's more affordable. Yeah, Nickelodeon is weird with the Blu-ray. I mean, it might not, like, the animation might not be high enough quality to go to Blu-ray. It might not.
Well, it's not widescreen, so that's probably half the issue, because it's only full screen still. I don't know if they're going to remaster it to be widescreen somehow and, like, cut off some of the image.
I'm interested. Might not be worth it.
Now.
Yeah. So in all my free time today, that will be written. Yeah, cool. All right, so let's get down to chapter 7, The Terror Within. A recap this week comes from Mitch, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Oh, and
I read your first line, Mitch, and I was like, oh, this is funny. I was like, you're right, Pabu isn't.
Well, the synopsis goes, in this chapter, the Red Lotus, which I guess we're just going to call a Red Lotus because we all know that now, shows that they are not fucking around, but thankfully neither is Pabu. Seriously, the crux of the fall of their plan was Pabu waking up. They should keep that canary around in all dangerous situations, and all situations in general, in my opinion. While Plea proves to be a particularly dangerous foe, Bolin takes her out with a well-aimed pebble, giving the Beifong sisters the opportunity to save Korra. Figuring out that an inside man let the Red Lotus in, Sue investigates her whole task force using a truth seer named Ai Wei. It's a shame that Ai Wei was the double agent, though, because now it's like, can Lin trust anything he's ever told her about the truth in her city? Anyway, you mean Sue?
Yeah, I kept doing that in the recap. I didn't catch that one.
Yeah. Okay, so Sue, yeah. Anyway, he escapes, blows up his house, and earns an express ticket on Avatar Korra's growing DOA list.
No, you didn't.
He actually said escapes, explodes, and earns, because I like the alliteration there, Mitch.
Right, but he doesn't explode, so I changed it.
But it sounds better that way.
I just wanted to, I was looking for the alliteration, and I was kind of just like, explodes, like... his library would be too much.
I value your alliteration, Mitch. I
appreciate the effort, but the MFA student in me is like, gotta clarify though.
Yeah, because
well, it's asinine, it's not alliteration.
And you guys did not read it. So.
It's okay, I'll survive.
But keep going, Mitch. Go, pursue that urge. It's a good urge. all right, so for some reason, Mitch thinks that Bopal is boring. But
only in this context.
I mean, they are a little boring, but they're still cute.
They're super cute. I love Bolin and Opal together. I think that they're adorable, and I think the relationship brings out... I mean, I shouldn't like relationship because it brings out something good in Bolin, but we know Bolin a lot more than better than we know Opal. And I really like that there's, like, no BS here, and she's just, like... They just like each other, and he's like willing to be more mature for her, and yeah, so I like it. Even if like they bond over Kale, But yes, Pabu is definitely the savior of the day because he wakes up and realizes that Korra is being kidnapped, and also poor Naga is taken out with those darts, which must be super powerful because they took out a polar bear dog. So it probably
So Korra gets her own room, right? She wasn't sharing with Asami. Because Mako and Bolin were sharing. Okay, that seems like very irresponsible to me, considering that Lin was like, no, we have to protect the Avatar because all these people were coming for her, and then she's like in her own room without anybody else. So they can take her.
Actually. Well, she has Naga, if you think about it, so she had just as good of a chance of being protected by her, I think, than any other human. With that roar, you can tell anyone else to come along and help.
That's true.
And I guess they thought the perimeter, you know, protection was going to be enough. I agree they should have had someone on Korra, but I think this also illustrates the fact that they just don't really know what they're up against with the Red Lotus. So what did we all think of the fight scene? I mean, like, this is the first time that we really get to see group in action against Starbenders, and yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Awesome. It was so cool.
Yeah, Adriana, like, was your mind blown from the, I guess I can call it special effects of this episode?
I just thought it was so exciting. Like, everybody fighting, and it was so cool to see, like, everybody in action, because it's kind of been a little while since we've gotten to see, like, them bend for, like, to save people. and I thought it was especially exciting. I loved seeing, like, everybody fighting in their underwear. I thought that was precious.
Didn't you love Asami's bed getup? Like, she had this
whole... Oh my god, yes!
Yeah, her whole gown, like, it was gorgeous.
I love that she, like, that's how she goes to bed. Like, she actually dresses like a Victoria's Secret... Like, she wears Victoria's Secret sleepwear to bed. Yeah. Of course. And then, like, you've got Korra in, like, sweatpants.
I mean, isn't she wearing, like, a tank top? Like, she just kind of, like, whatever, it was underneath.
Yeah.
So Korra sleeps like everyone sleeps, and Asami sleeps like we all wish that we sleep.
I know, like, yeah. An elegant princess.
Yeah.
And she still has her makeup on when she sleeps. Do you think she's like, it's like tattooed on or something?
Oh my god, she was getting ready for bed, and she was wearing her dressing gown.
Some girls wear their makeup to bed.
Which is like, really bad, by the way. Don't do that.
It is really bad for you, but...
Is yeah. it because you don't get a break?
Sometimes it's worth it. No, it's because they're afraid, like, when they... Like, in case they get woken up. They want to make sure they look good.
Yeah, in case the Red Lotus is coming. Like, maybe we caught her in the one night that she was thinking about that.
Yeah,
she was
but...
just like, this is the scene, I just smell a threat. I better keep
but,
on
like,
my
seriously,
eyeliner.
Take off your makeup before you go to sleep, because it ages you, like, crazy. And it's really bad for your skin. Sorry, I'm a skincare junkie, so that's, yeah, a pet peeve of mine. And don't use wipes. Use actual makeup remover. Okay, sorry, we're talking about Korra. Caitlin, do you have any thoughts on this, like, crazy epic fight scene?
I just love seeing all the different types of bending coming together and how both sides are using various types of bending to fight each other. And it's so... They have such ingenious ways of going at each other, and it just looks fantastic.
Yeah, it really does. We get that amazing slow motion hit on Palee from Bolin, which we actually see, like, kind of foreshadowed in the opening scene when Bolin does a similar thing with the pebble to whichever twin he's fighting. So that was cool. And yeah, I think it's also a good point that this has been kind of I don't want to say talky, but sort of more of a negotiating-ish season. Whereas season two was kind of like hopping from like fight to fight, and then this season has been building up to kind of this kind of conflict. And once we get it feels like very much of a release, even though it's terrifying because Korra is her life is literally in danger. Yeah, any other thoughts on the fight?
I really love seeing like the two together. And then Mako and Bolin working together, and I loved that. It was like the two sisters and the two brothers working together. That was really nice.
Yeah, totally. And it was, you know, I really liked how everything kind of came together. You know, people were definitely, like, they were still themselves. They weren't just like, okay, we're Mighty Morphin Power Rangers now, but, like, and there were still arguments and still, you know, miscommunications, but, you know, their goal definitely focused them. And they, you know, and, but it was all, what was also interesting was that the Red Lotus was equally as determined, you know, like, I never felt that the outcome of this fight was certain.
I thought they were going to take her. I for reals thought they were going to take her. So I was kind of surprised when the good guys won.
They work really well together for having been separated in prison for 13 years.
They spend a lot of time training since they got back. That's basically what they've been doing. Yeah, I don't remember if this is the first time we've seen lava bending on this scale.
Who does lava bending? Is that the Earthbender?
Yeah, Kazan.
That's cool. I love it when people think outside the box.
Yeah. And it was fun how awestruck that was by Bolin.
Yes.
I mean, how awestruck Bolin was by that. Cool. So after this fight, we kind of, you know, in the aftermath, it becomes, I guess understandably, but maybe not so wisely, everybody in Xiaofu kind of gets obsessed with figuring out where the leak is and how these people got in. So we have Ai Wei basically manipulating these interrogations. And yeah, I mean, Caitlin, do you remember like how, like what you thought the first time you saw these interrogations? How did you feel about how they were being carried out, whether they would be accurate? Did you suspect Ai Wei of anything?
I think I was more suspicious of Sue, just because I'd been kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop with her, and it hadn't come yet, and this seemed for the perfect opportunity for it to be like, and it turns out she's crooked after all, and then it didn't happen, which was a surprise to me.
That's funny. I thought it was the truth-seer guy, definitely. I was like, it's this guy, guys. He's like the one telling you everybody's lying. He's the liar.
Did it seem like he came to the conclusion that there was a leak too quick? Like, not that there was a leak, but that they needed to investigate everyone? Because he was kind of like, you know, right after Koro goes, it had to have been one of the guards. He's like, okay, cool, let's interview everyone.
Yeah, and it is kind of a...
Okay, I have a question. So I don't understand why this man is so special, because we know that Toph could tell lies with her feet. Like Lin and Sue not do that?
From what it seems like Toph was just such a BAMF that we were kind of spoiled to see her, you know, being able to see underground, which, you know, we've seen Lin do.
Lin does that, yeah.
Right, but it seems like that's the only real ability that anyone else has really done as easily. And no one else is a conglomerate. No one else really seems to be able to do all of the awesome things she was able to do. So if you're a metal bender, you won't necessarily be able to also truth see, because that's just like you would have won the genetic lottery if you did. But it would make sense, you know, I guess in that sense, that Lin and Sue would be able to do all of the above, right?
Well, I don't think that... I mean, given Ai Wei's, like... first of all, Toph has a quote-unquote advantage in this way, in that she is blind, so she has to... Like, she kind of has to be more in tune to the way she's seeing through her feet, I think. You know, whereas everybody else can kind of use it as an add-on. But, I mean, if you look at the way Ai Wei's personality appears to be, like, he strikes me as a very kind of observant, thoughtful person, and that would lend itself to being able to, like, to lie detect through earthbending, whereas, you know, Sue and Lin are a little bit more volatile. Like, I don't think they really would have put the effort into concentrating and, you know, because I don't assume it's just like, you know, oh, let me listen with my feet for a minute and, like, your heartbeat changed, so I know that, you know, it's a lot more subtle than that. Like, reading a lie, like a real-life lie detection is complicated. It's not super easy. So I would imagine it's similar in the Avatar universe. That makes sense?
Yeah, no, I get where you're coming from. Because, you know, it's not like everyone can have everything, because if they did, it would just start to, I think, become less special. But I don't think that they really defined that it was so special that Toph was able to truth see in the original series, which is why I think it comes as just a shock that this guy is so special that he's the one that does this. We're like, wait, can everyone do it? I mean, we were introduced to that very casually. But I get the whole blind thing, too. It's like,
yeah, I just assumed that Lynn could.
It'd be nice if Lynn could. I mean, she is.
I feel like if Lynn could, that would be a really good thing for a. But if you think about it, like she would probably use that all the time as a cop, right?
Yeah. So I feel like we would have seen her do it already.
Well, maybe she just doesn't say it. Maybe she's doing it like secretly because we know that she can still like retract her foot, her sole of her foot on her shoe, so that she can see underground. So. Who's to say she wouldn't be doing that all the time to test out lying and not telling everyone? That'd be like the perfect.
But then she would have known that Mako was innocent instead of throwing in.
Oh, yeah, and she also would have known that Sue was just doing what she was doing at the end of this episode. You know, placating her, really.
Oh, yes. Oh, Sue.
And again, it makes sense to me just because I don't see it as her personality, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Lynn's personality, I see it definitely more as Lynn's personality than, like, Toph's personality. I feel like Lynn is so freaking anal, like, that she would be like, I have to learn this.
It always kind of, you know, is strange to me that every once in a while we have a really powerful character, like, I mean, Lynn or Korra, that don't learn the full extent of their bending when they seem to be so into it. Like, I still don't understand that as a waterbending avatar, how Korra does not know how to bloodbend, doesn't seem to be interested in doing it, even as a defense mechanism. I feel like it's important for her to learn. I mean, it would have been nice to know how to fight back against Noatak a bit more, I think, but...
See, I think it's as simple as it's evil, and, you know, Katara probably gave her a speech about how it was evil at some point, and, like, you know, there's sort of, you know, I guess that's kind of an argument that you could make, you know, if you have this, you know, this thing that can be used for evil, is it better to use it or to, like, try and get rid of it, you know, even if some people might use it. And, you know, I think definitely the spirit of the Avatar verse is that you don't use it, because that can bring you down to the level of the people who do. I mean, to, like, one of the things
that just seems a little bit bizarre to me, because, like, in martial arts, you learn how to kill people. But it's not so that you go out and kill people. It's like to defend yourself, and you don't ever expect to have to.
Well, I mean, yeah, like, but that's like a physical, you know, like somebody that you're, I don't know, like there's no guarantee, I guess, that you're going to like kill someone if you know martial arts. Whereas like bloodbending, you can automatically like super control them, and you know.
If you know. You can automatically choke someone to death, like...
Well, you know what? I think I can think of a pretty realistic real-world explanation for what's going on here and why this is so twisted in my mind, and why I think of Katara as more of the thought police here, because there's a move in wrestling called, I don't know, I think it's the full Nelson, where if you put your arms underneath someone's armpits and you snake them back up behind their neck, you could snap their neck very easily. But with one arm only that you're controlling them with, you can just control them. And that's like a legitimate move in wrestling that you're meant to do. So it's kind of taught to you even from a young age that, like, you know, this is kind of specific too. You can control someone with this. You could really like stop them. They can't move. They can't escape. With a full Nelson, you can kill someone with both arms in it. And I think that it's okay that I knew that. Like, I even think that even at a young age, Katara should have been taught what bloodbending was, just so she knows how to defend against it, because people are still going to use it. There's no way you can shut out the idea. And then if you know how to use it, you can defend against the people who are truly doing it for nefarious reasons. I don't think there's anything in a move
or an ability. But for most waterbenders, bloodbending can only be done under the full moon.
Right, and that's still legitimate, because I think that there are a lot of waterbenders.
Most of them. There's the exceptions.
You know, bloodbending is just...
Exactly, so I think it's all the more important that the avatar or somebody knows how to take care of it.
Yeah.
Because it's rare, so people are like, what is this?
I would want the most powerful bender in the world to know how to bloodbend. I don't know, it's a debate. Let us know how you feel. I'm anti-bloodbending, personally.
turns out, shock of shocks, that Ai Wei, the man who can hear everyone's lies, is the actual liar. And he's really actually not very smart, because he picked somebody who it would, if anybody thought about it for 2 seconds, which Yamako he did, makes absolutely no sense. Whereas if he'd picked like an older person, you know, maybe this lie would have survived. So was anyone actually surprised that this was Ai Wei at fault? He's secretly evil.
I don't know that I really
had. He's a creepy guy.
Well, you know, I didn't really have time, I think, initially when I was watching this episode to suss out too much of what was going on. I mean, I guess that you kind of have a weird introduction to him that he's like, there's no secrets in this city because of me. And you're like, okay, that smells. So then, and then when you get to this, it's, I think it's like such a quick revelation within a, you know, 22-minute episode. And it's a very busy 22-minute episode, so that I don't have time to like sit and think about like, you know, this is such a Scooby-Doo episode, like, whodunit, like, who's behind the mask?
Oh, and I was so going, true. I would have gotten away with it if it weren't for you meddling kids.
Yes. And that dog! Oh, no! It's so true.
Oh. And that fire ferret, too.
Bolin is such a too. Shaggy.
Bolin is a Shaggy, that's very
yes,
true.
Bolin's a good Shaggy.
But, yeah, so... You know, he escapes. He's, like, clearly evil, whatever. You know, things get kind of violent. There's a bomb. Korra protects everyone with her airbending, which was pretty boss. And, yeah, were you guys expecting things to get quite that, like, serious? Like, oh, okay, this guy's actually going to, like, blow up his escape as opposed to just...
Well, I thought once again that he was going to, like, win... And find a way to take them or something, or find a way to trick everybody into him being okay. Like, I thought he would do a better job of...
Yeah, he's kind of incompetent.
Taking them down. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no, now you know they've really got Korra. No.
Well, yeah. I wonder if, as a true seer, you could anticipate your opponent's moves, much like Noatak was anticipating... all the bending moves, and I guess he was also blood bending to make people like to make it easier to dodge moves. Like if you think back to like when Korra blew up a large fireball into his balloon as he was escaping the pro bending arena in like episode 4, then I feel like he was like what bending Korra's arm to get away from it. I feel like in a truth seer aspect though, you could still kind of do the same thing because you could almost see into the future like of what was going to happen. It almost feels like. I don't know if, like, Daredevil does that, but, like, there's a Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie where he's, like, on a bike. I can't remember what it's called. And he, like, is
oh
able
my
to...
God, Rush.
Rush. And he's able to see the different circumstances. Like, if he goes one way, he'll get hit by a car. If he goes another way, he'll, like, dodge it or something. That's how I would anticipate a truth seer being able to fight.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think Ai Wei is a fighter. I think that's part of his thing. And I think, again, like... He would have to be concentrating on, you know, when he's truth telling, he's like sitting, you know, and somebody's talking, you know, as opposed to like he's facing the Avatar and two other like serious benders and he's trying to escape. So for me, I wouldn't necessarily like somebody maybe could do it, like Toph maybe could do that, but I wouldn't really think Ai Wei could do it.
Well, and then
he's basically
a fighter.
Human polygraph.
What do you say,
right. I was going to say, he's basically a human polygraph, which doesn't really lend itself to other uses, just sitting there and being the, yes, they're lying, no, they're not lying.
Right.
Right, like, you couldn't read somebody's polygraph test and be like, oh, you were going to go left, you know, it would just be like, no, I don't like yogurt, you know, it's not really related, I think.
Well, in that he's not a fighter, do you think he was ready to poison everyone with that very suspicious-looking tea?
I totally thought that.
Yes! I was like, don't drink the tea! Don't drink it!
He could have been. I don't know. He's a weird guy. I don't know. The whole Ai Wei thing. Ai Wei's an interesting, but ultimately kind of frustrating character, because we don't know a lot about him, but, like,
and then, like, nothing
evil.
Happens, right?
There's, no, but like, he dies resolved. A really horrible death.
Yeah. He dead? Is he dead because his body, like, his body's still there?
Oh, he's so dead asleep. No, but his body's alive, but his spirit isn't there, so he's just gonna, like, rot.
Yeah.
I mean,
But is it like a vegetable?
Well, like, it's like, remember when Janora...
Is he like a vegetable?
Do you remember when Janora started to like rot almost? I guess like Katara had to like keep her like body rejuvenated with like water bending.
Oh, juju. That's true. That's true.
So he's going to die within like a week. His physical body and his spirit, I guess, continues on because we have, I don't know, it's weird because like I think of like General Zhao and how he's still like...
I wonder if Jet's down there.
You know, it was really unclear.
It's really unclear, Adianos. He's still alive somewhere, right?
you know, every time I ever use the words, it's really unclear, I feel like I'm referencing Avatar, even if I'm talking about, like, what the weather's going to be.
Well, in the end of the day, though, I think it's just, like, there's a weird, I don't think of where you go into the spirit world and where you don't, because, like, even, like, Uncle Iroh going in kind of confuses me, because he's like, I chose to be here. And then we have, like I was saying, General Zhao, like, his body was taken, so I assumed that meant he died, and his spirit was then brought into that, you know, weird Lost Souls area.
Probably because he killed the moon, and so they were like, yeah, you can't go anywhere happy now.
So that's like his purgatory, I suppose.
Well, I mean, yeah, when you get, like, personally dragged by the water, or the water spirit into the spirit world. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're not. Yeah. You don't have a chance. And I didn't have a chance, but well, that's the next episode. So this has been a brief discussion about the next episode, but we'll get there in a little bit. I wasn't sure if the tea was poisoned, but it definitely could have been a possibility. This guy's kind of a coward and takes the easy way out. But yeah. So then everybody basically is like, we're going to go. We're tracking this guy, Sue decides to cover for the crew when they escape, basically from Lynn. So any thoughts on that? Any ideas about Ariana? What did you think about this whole like not exactly going to tell Lynn what's really going on?
Oh my gosh! Okay, this is what I mean about like. Last week, or no, a few weeks ago, when I was like, yes, Lynn is being immature, but also, like, she's right. Sue hasn't changed. Like, she's still, like, she just thinks that she should rather, like, it's better to seek forgiveness than permission, but she does that for everything. And it's just, I think, like, being Lynn, I can see how that would be super, super annoying that. Why can't we talk this out, Sue? Why can't we, like, oh, great, thanks for doing things behind my back again, because you know best, obviously. And that's just really annoying that she, like, played her. I was like, do I agree with Lynn in this situation? I don't know if I agree that Korra needs to stay there, kept secret and safe. But I definitely don't agree with Sue just being like, yeah, go, whatever, especially after she just, like, you know, made things good with Lynn and she's pulling this shit again. It's like, this is why we can't have nice things, Sue.
Well, I think Sue definitely demonstrates, you know, she isn't the most, I don't know, the word mature is weird to use, but like the way she reacts when like there's this assumption that somebody in Xiaofu is a traitor, you know, is like super extreme, you know, and to me, I was just like, whoa, like, let's check things out for a second. Let's make sure that this is actually true. Let's, you know, but no, Sue really wants to get revenge on somebody who has violated her principles, which, by the way, keep that in mind. Might be important later. I think it was definitely very much in character, but I definitely see why it was. And, you know, you want Korra to be able to go, but it's also like, I can see why there would be major objections to this behavior. Caitlin, any thoughts?
Again, that was the first time I watched it. I thought something sketchy was going to happen with Lynn or with Sue because there was so much setup for her to be super sketchy. And then it turned out she was helping Korra. But I don't know. It seems like you're sending this group off without like legitimate, useful backup in the form of Lynn.
Yes.
Like, that seems irresponsible.
And then, well, this is in the next episode, I guess. But then, like, when I thought Lynn would be, like, way angrier, she's just like, oh. She's like, of course you did this. bye.
Well, I feel like you haven't seen, as far as my memory doesn't remember, so non-spoilerly, I feel like we haven't seen in general, like, the full repercussions of Sue's actions here.
That's true, because they don't know yet that, like, Cora was captured.
Like, I think there's still more reaction to come, if I had to guess, from what storytelling can do.
Lynn's gonna be pissed.
Yeah.
It just seems very selfish of Sue to send them off and be like, well, I really want revenge on this guy, so let's put the whole fate of the world at risk. You go, Cora.
That's so Sue, though. Like, I don't want to, I guess, confirm or deny if there ultimately is something sketchy about her, but she really, I mean, Sue does what Sue wants to do, and you know, that is a super consistent marker of her behavior. And I think you even get that at the beginning of this episode, where she's throwing this massive goodbye party for Opal, you know, when, like, yeah, it's a big deal, like, for sure, don't get me wrong, but, like, it's almost like when a kid goes off to be to, like, study in another country or something, you know, like, you have a family party and it's like, oh my gosh, I'm so proud of you, I'm gonna miss you so much, but, like, this is like, Opal is going off to leave us and, you know, study airbending, and, you know, she almost imbues it with this grandeur that, like, to kind of make herself feel better, I think, that this is happening almost against her will. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So Sue's a complicated character, and I'm not her biggest fan, but she's definitely, she's interesting. She has a lot of layers. Like an onion.
Oh, somebody had to. Thank you.
Well, I was going to say like kale, but kale really doesn't have layers. It just has wrinkles.
Like a cabbage, we'll say.
Like a cabbage. Like
for the very first... Okay, we'll stop.
Cabbage actually has both layers and wrinkles, so that's perfect. That is
perfect.
And this is looking pretty good, must be said. All right, so, any last thoughts on The Terror Within?
I really liked when I wrote that note in about, like, Cora having trouble still metal bending, because I thought it was so unrealistic when Aang was able to earthbend and, like, make that rock suit against Azula in the drill.
That's my favorite line. Or one of my favorite lines.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and I like the idea that, like, her skill earlier in the episode doesn't necessarily translate all the time. You know, mm-hmm. Like, she can do this on the practice field, but it's not the same as doing it in competition, theoretically, you know.
And how awesome is that shot, too, when she, like, opens up the metal and she jumps through it? Like, that's such a, like, the Banff team is here to, like, F stuff up. I love it.
Yeah. I also want to give one shout out, oh man, Ariana's our only newbie. Okay, but... if you're a newbie, this won't make any sense to you, but there is a character that, like, watching this again, it's like, whoa, okay, wow, they were there.
Yes, they were there.
Yes.
Wow.
I didn't want to say anything. I thought everyone was going to yell at me for spoiling everything, so there
you go. I can say
it. How exciting.
No.
Exciting.
Don't.
Where? Like, where were they there? At the dinner table? At the fight?
Yes. Don't stress about it. Just
it's a better surprise, yeah. Ariana. It's unlike, I mean, it's a better surprise if it comes as a surprise. I'll give you that much.
Yeah, and this is something that I think it ties into season four, and, like, you know, in season four.
No, that's so long.
Yeah, no, it's not long. Don't worry, these episodes go really fast. But I just wanted to say kudos to the creators, because it's not the type of thing that feels like it's there, but oh my god, it's there. Anyway,
it is. And then
And you guys will be like, was there?
You'll know what we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's going to be even funnier because
of this season, you'll know what we're talking about.
And you will. And you, I think I won't say anything at all. I promise. I know I'm bad at spoilers, but I'm being good here. I think Ariana, you in particular, are going to be very frustrated, because you'll just say, like, how did X do X and I didn't X?
That was just meaningless, Mitch.
Yeah, sorry, Mitch. That didn't make any sense. I didn't know what you were talking about there. All right, but anyway, Mitch, what is your favorite scene in this episode?
Okay, so mine is Korra's, like, split-second reaction to do that airbending bubble. I love the animation when you see kind of, like, a really good close-up of her face. It's really well animated, and the fire in her eyes. And she has maybe, like, half of a millisecond to form that airbending bubble. It is so on point, and I love it. I love
yes.
when Korra uses airbending as, like, a reactionary defense.
Major yeah, props. Sure. That was some smart moves, Korra.
And I guess she really could have just made, like, a rock thing, but that would have taken longer.
Yeah, it would have taken longer, and then they wouldn't have had air, because fire creates a vacuum, so.
Right, and you also could have had Mako and Korra kind of sustain the explosion, but I think it still would have done a lot of damage, because we kind of see him trying to control the explosion at that peace rally in Season 2, and he does a decent job at it, where he's able to kind of, like, quell the fire back.
Yeah, but it reminded me of that scene in the Incredibles when Violet makes the at the end. Like,
yes.
The yeah.
And or how about just it. Like the airplane? Even just like that's so emotional. That's kind of, that's what it harkens back to when the airplane's going to explode, and she just like tries to make the thing, and then the mom makes her body as the thing, doesn't she?
Oh yeah.
Oh, that gives
yeah.
Me
but
so
I'm
many
saying
feels.
This is like an explosion, and she kind of protects them from it.
Like last minute, just like quick.
So looking forward to it. Anyway, Ariana, lower the tone for us a bit, please.
So mine was definitely when everyone, like, jumped out of bed in their underwear. I thought that was precious. I have to give major props to Mako, who is, like, such a cop, because, like, Bolin just has to be, he's like, oh, Pabu, no, go away. And he's like, they've got Korra! And Mako's just like, bam, out of bed, running out, like...
Mm-hmm.
He woke yeah. up so fast, so major props to Cop Mako and to Asami's Victoria's Secret getup.
Yep.
Also, I thought it was funny.
She was about to take off her makeup.
I can't help but be reminded, Ariana, of a rewatchable past with the Veronica Mars Victoria's Secret sleepover commercial, where it'd be like, we love Veronica Mars, not their lingerie. Like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Throwback Thursday.
Here, I wrote down what everybody had. Bolin and Mako had sexy casual boxers on. Soo-yin is still like in her full getup, which I thought was hilarious. I am surprised they both had shirts on, because that's really... But whatever.
Mako and Bolin.
Yeah, but maybe
Did
they feel more
just
comfortable.
Over?
I have no clue what that giant crash is in the room. It was like a poltergeist just decided
Caitlin,
somewhere.
Are you okay, Caitlin?
I was on mute.
No, it was me. I muted it like oh. the second it happened, but I missed it.
No worries. Caitlin, what was your favorite scene?
So mine was during the fight when they're saying that the combustion bender needs to get taken out, and Mako just immediately is like, Bolin can make the shot. Just he has this complete unwavering confidence in his brother. And I liked seeing that. And I picked a runner-up because Natalie wanted us to mention that the guard that they suspect as the traitor who's the setup was played by StarKid's Joey Richter. So he's
oh,
a
really?
Big fan of Avatar, and he got to have a little cameo.
Wasn't he on Glee as well because he was a fan?
He had a brief... part, yes.
During that horrible Baby Got Back debacle?
Yes. Yes.
We would talk about that.
Joey Richter played Ron?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Alright, I know who he is.
And he was adorable. The way he was animated, it was so cute. He was like, truly just like this baby-faced cop that you were like, no, like, don't hate him. He's legit.
Yeah, seriously, not the smartest... Because there are some tough-looking cops there. I mean, guards there. He's just such an idiot. Anyway, my favorite scene
You know who
was,
he should have pinned it on was totally... He should have pinned it on Varric. He's, like, already a criminal.
Yeah.
And he's the new guy in town.
Or if he really wanted to shake things up, why not Sue? Like, what's stopping him?
Well, I feel like that... the thing is, he can't pick someone,
People trust
and maybe
Sue.
This is the problem with Varric. People trust Sue, and Varric is too smart, maybe, to set up. Like, he... Like, this cop couldn't defend himself. Like, he didn't have the means to do that, you know? I keep saying cop. This guard, you know, didn't have the means to do that. But, you know, Sue or... yeah, I mean, what was even the purpose of this misdirection? I'm not even... Now that I think about it, what was... I guess to just distract everybody and, like, make his escape?
Yeah. I think it was like, I think it was a means to have him, A, destroy his library full of Red Lotus stuff... and B, to give us more of even like an ending action sequence, because we started off so strong that they probably wanted to give us a little bit something more just to, like, you know, keep your thirst going.
Right. No, but from Aiwei's point of view, like, why was he like, we need to, like, I need to set up somebody to take my fall? You know, did he plan on sticking around Jafu?
I think so. I think he wanted to still continue to be the Red Lotus's spy so he can keep on sending them, like, secret messages.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Well, my favorite scene was when they tried to interrogate Varric and it went horribly wrong because it's Varric. And I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about Varric. Sometimes I literally despise him and sometimes I love him quite a bit. So this time I liked him. moving on to favorite lines, Mitchell, go for it.
So mine is Sue, and she's so intense and fierce. She's like the Beyonce of the Metal Clan here. She goes, question them all. Whoever betrayed my city will suffer the consequences.
Sue has no chill.
Sue has no chill. Until she has all the chill, and then she has too much chill.
Right.
So mine was Mako and Korra being their most Mako and Korra ever. And so when the guy is, like, getting away, Mako's like, come on, he's getting away. He's like, Korra, do something. And Korra's, like, trying to metal bend, and he's stressing her out instead of being, like, letting her do her thing. And she's like, I'm still a little new at this, so back off. And I was like, yeah, Mako, back off. Girl is trying to get it done. She, like, just learned how to metal bend, and now you want her to, like, move walls.
Well, you know what's interesting here? I thought she was yelling at Bolin, wasn't she? Not Mako. I could be remembering incorrectly, but either way, it's interesting. No,
I'm pretty sure it was Mako, because I was like, you guys.
Well, it's just, like, an interesting, like, even if it's, depending on what brother it was, we'll go with Mako, because I have a bad memory. It's kind of interesting, because it's like, you know, almost like a remnant of their relationship in the past, because they have a closeness where they would bicker like that in a relationship, and now that they're just friends, it's like, sometimes it leaks its way back into, like, their day-to-day normal conversation, or whatever. This isn't normal, but you know what I mean.
I just liked how intense he was and how she was, like, really stressed out.
What I love about this is that they're still working together, you know, like you pointed out earlier, you know, Mako still, like, Bolin's like, they've got Korra, and he's like, up, you know. Mm-hmm. I really like the way they've kind of hit this balance of, like, them being able to return to being friends and working together, and obviously it's not always perfect by any means, but that kind of base respect that it takes to work together definitely is being restored, and I like that a lot. There's a lot of repairing of the crap of season two that goes on in this season, I think, on a very subtle level. Yeah. Caitlin, what was your favorite line?
So mine was when the fight first starts and we see the lava bending the first time, and Bolin's like, no way, that guy's lava bending, that's awesomely not good for us. Like, I love how he's, like, so excited and then, like, wait, that's really bad.
Such a good voice actor for Bolin. PJ Byrne,
I think his name is. Oh, he's amazing. Yeah, PJ Byrne. He's the best. So I'm totally uncreative, and my favorite line was Varric's interrogation, which was basically like, what was I doing last night? And he's like, so happy that somebody's asking him. He's like, same thing as I always do. From 9 to 10, I check my body for ticks. Lyme disease is a serious killer. Then I did my nightly Varric calisthenics, followed by 30 minutes of breath holding. I filmed the whole thing if you want to watch it. Yeah, I love that.
I was thinking of Pinky in the Brain. The same thing I do every night.
The world.
That's kind of Varric probably does. Yes.
Yeah, that was totally. Yeah, that was awesome. So now we are moving on to chapter 8, the stakeout. In this chapter, we are forced to watch a stakeout. It's literally like Bryke wanted us to feel as bored as the crew was for the first half. The second half, actually. But, well, I guess probably the first half. Anyway,
I thought it was
thanks
cute.
To Tara, the action. I actually love the stakeout too, so I disagree with you, Mitch, but I do think it's handled well and that you feel the time passing. Anyway, thanks, Utara. The action picks up because if I had to sit through another minute of Pie Show, that was charming. Shut up. Korra enters the spirit world to witness Zaheer throwing Aiwei's soul into General Zhao's moving arm. Yeah, I was definitely gay. I think they actually confirmed that. While entertaining Korra's questions, Zaheer orders Ming Hua and Gazan to tell to teleport in an instant to Misty Palm's oasis. That poor hotel manager's worst fear came to fruition when the set of teenagers trashed not only their room, but the entire estate building thing in a boiling collapse of melted earth. Minghua bests the Fire Ferret brothers. She like, whips their asses. She destroys them. But Earth Kingdom troops capture Korra, Asami, and Naga before Gazan can retrieve them. Hello, Clarice. Wait, why are we referencing Silence of the Lambs?
Is it because she's wearing that mask?
Oh, yeah, okay, I get that, yeah.
I have to say now, I accidentally tweeted out a picture of that too early, and Brittany was so upset that I spoiled her, because I deleted it, like, a second after I put it out, but it was tagged at Rewatchable, and Brittany knows now what I was talking about, because I, like, made, it was, like, a meme, and I'll send it out just for fun. And you can see what it was, and it was just talking. It was like as if Korra was Hannibal Lecter, and it's really funny. I love it. It's my favorite Korra meme.
Yeah. All right. That happens. That happens. All right. So in this episode, basically, you know, Korra did the Sokka Water Tribe thing. I don't remember that. What did she do?
Well, they like leaving. With an actual memory. They're leaving the bar, and
oh yeah.
What a tribe. But she didn't say it. She just kind of, like, did the look.
Yeah.
It was, like, the same exact shot. It was really cool.
It was
a callback, yeah.
That was a great scene, too. Like, the wanted posters were hilarious. That was, yeah.
I have a question about Jeeps here. Okay, so Jeep is a type of car, and Jeep is a brand. I think they're walking a fine line, and if they, like, were endorsed by Jeep, I get it. But if not, that's really weird.
No, I think Jeep is actually, well, Jeep is a brand, but I think it's, there's a word for it. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's certain, like you can say, like, give me a Kleenex when you have a box of Puffs, and you still know that you mean a tissue, you know, because, like, that's, like, there are certain brands that become so iconic that they become the word for the thing, and Jeep is one of those things. I don't know actually which way. Like, maybe they were called Jeep before Jeep came around.
Right.
But I don't think, like, there's a copyright thing on that or anything.
I just found it really interesting that they were just, Jeep, like, specifically...
Jeep would be a really weird sponsor for Nickelodeon.
Well, I even think that they had, like, capital Jeep. Like, J was capitalized, too. So I was like, is this meant to be, like, sponsored by the brand Jeep? And I was like, whoa, this is different for a cartoon.
Unlikely, but we'll see. I don't know. Maybe. Anything's possible. If that was the case, though, maybe they wouldn't have relegated it to the internet. Because at this point, season 3 was airing online.
Right.
So, you know, the early part of the episode is really kind of hilarious, in my opinion, because everybody escapes from Jafu slash Lin. And they're kind of like, how do we do this? Like, how do we, you know, Misty Palm's Oasis, how do we figure this out? And so they, Mako and Balin don ridiculously dumb identities, which I found hysterical, before we get to the stakeout. And they run into fans of Balin, and it's all very funny. So, Caitlin, how did you feel about the early part of this episode? Which ends up getting quite dark, actually, but the early part is really... kind of an interesting balance to that.
I find it quite charming because the downtime with the group is just fun because you see their dynamic and how the dynamic has evolved and when they're all pretty much just friendly to each other and how they're working together. And I enjoy just seeing them play off each other. So I had a lot of fun at the beginning of this episode.
And obviously yeah,
it's nice to see them not fighting. You know, it's nice to see them not hating each other and just, again, like, it's not like everything works perfectly because that's not realistic, but they function together very well. Ariana, in contrast to Mitch, are you with Mitch? Did you not like this or did you enjoy it like me and Caitlin did? Caitlin and I.
I really liked the pie show. I thought it was funny how Asami was, like, totally kicking his ass. So, yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I liked how cramped.
She's like, I learned from the evil mastermind. Hello.
Yeah, I definitely love the stakeout. Like, I think that's. I mean, I love how realistic it is. First of all, I love that Mako is like he knows what to do. You know, he knows where to look. He knows how to get a room. Even though that's
ultimately thanks to Bolin. Also, weird thing though, every time they have somebody, and by they I mean like Mike and Brian, they put in a character who's like a fan, I get a little uncomfortable because I'm sure they have met this fan, you know, and like with the doll, with the Nuck-Tuck doll, like I made this for you, and it's like I've seen dolls that look like that online. You know,
people make dolls of them because I get making dolls of like characters, or people sometimes make dolls of actors, like, but as the character, but making a doll of like the actor as a human or the actor as like the writers, that seems really bizarre.
Actually, I don't know if they've done that, but I've seen like definitely like Korra plushies, like fan made and stuff like that, you know, That style, I know somebody online who makes similar things like that, and she makes like Richard Armitage ones because she's a Hannibal fan, and they really look like that. I could probably link her Etsy store, but yeah. So I agree. I honestly really like the beginning. I love the pie show thing. Mitch, why don't you like this? It's charming and wonderful. What's wrong with you?
It's because it feels like it's meant to be boring. And, like, there's a line that I almost chose as my favorite. Maybe I did. Let me see if I did. Okay, I did. Okay, so I'm not going to mention it yet. But regardless, I agree with Bolin, and I agree with the way that the show feels. It's like, if you know it's boring, why are you torturing us through it? If the only reason I could think of is because they wanted this to feel like be right there with that stakeout. I mean, heck, they did a pretty good job. I mean, I felt like I was just as bored as them, and I feel like there was, like, a good 5 minutes worth where you could just, like, be doing something else and come back, and you wouldn't have missed anything important.
I mean, all you're really seeing is, like, time passing, and, you know, I mean, like, they get into the room, they're like, oh, this is gonna take a while, and then the Pie Show thing happens, which is hilarious. I mean, I'm not trying to change your mind, because you're entitled to your opinion. But, like, for me, it was, like, a good way of being realistic about how this would actually go, and also kind of being entertaining, because it was awesome to see Pie Show back, and I love the whole, like, there actually are different ways of playing this game, because it's, like, a cultural thing, and, like, you know, it would have been cool, actually, if the handbook had a shout-out to the White Lotus. I think, especially in this episode, that would have been an interesting thing to point out.
Well, the only thing is like, I think of where in, like, Atla, even, they would have a scene where they're, quote, waiting for something or just doing nothing. Like, my God, hashtag the beach. They had awesome conversations there. They really could have delved deep into, like, some kind of flashback here.
Oh, something. I see. You wanted them to have, like, a Breakfast Club moment where they, like, aired out their dirty laundry in that little room.
It's the perfect opportunity. Like, it feels like stories are written to get to moments like this where characters can finally unveil, like, their true motivations or, like, what's going on behind the scenes, like, what we don't see. Like, maybe, for instance, we'll see, like, Asami and Bolin have, like, an awkward moment where we realize that they've been together this whole time, or, like, just something crazy. Just, like, anything fun. But it feels like they were just like, okay, we've developed these characters enough. You don't need to see anything more. We're just going to have them do what their task is.
That actually, now that you say that like that, I mean, I did really enjoy this scene, but now I'm a little bit disappointed because obviously now they're split up. So this is going to be the last time in a little while that they're all going to be together in a room. So it would have been nice if they had like tried to resolve some of their issues or maybe brought up some new issues that are going to leave them hanging while they're separated.
Because they do have stuff they need to resolve. Going on now? Like, I mean,
and they stuff always that have isn't, issues.
Like, left over. Well, yeah, they always have issues, but, like, I don't know, for me it seems so kind of, like, not drama-free, obviously, but compared to last season, it's just kind of, like, I don't know, it was, like, friends hanging out, you know, and I actually appreciate it when shows do this and take the time, like, to invest the time with value just because people are, like, hanging out together, and it's something that I thought Atla did pretty well, too. Like, sometimes they were just on Appa's back, like, chilling, you know? Like, not everything is an opportunity for deep, meaningful conversation, especially when you're expecting something to happen. I mean, I see what you're saying, though. Caitlin, any weighing in? Any thoughts on this particular thing?
I mean, the thing that stuck out to me was that we were seeing kind of, like, Bolin and Asami is not the usual pair of people to go off together. So it was kind of nice just to see a different couple of people interacting in a friendly way, so you could see more of how their group dynamic has evolved with all this drama going on, and that they are friends and all this. So I thought it did develop their dynamic a little more, because we haven't seen all that much with Bolin and Asami together, and the crux of that whole thing was a lot of the Bolin and Asami interaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, so anyway, after the boring stakeout, or not boring stakeout, however you interpret it, they realize that that actually Ai Wei has been in the room the whole time, and he is meditating, and he is in the what's it called, the oasis place,
Zhai Bao's garden.
Yeah, Zhai Bao's grove or whatever. Grove? Yeah, so because they're in the Misty Palms Oasis and in the real world. And they're like, where's Zhai Bao's Grove? Turns out it's in the spirit world. So, Korra goes in after him, after Ai Wei. I don't know how this works, that she can just show up in the place that he is in. I don't get that, but that's fine. She does. And she arrives just in time.
You know how Donnie Darko can see people's paths and like their energy and stuff? Like, I feel like she would follow like his tunnel to like how he got to there.
I guess it sort of seems she just like materialized where she needed to be, but that's fine. I mean, the spirit world has weird physics,
Rava does know like everything ever, so you can assume that Rava would be like, "Don't worry, Korra, I'll take over from here," and then. Maybe it's like flu powder, you know? If you have someone that knows the way, or you can just say, like, Zhai Bao's Grove, you'll be there.
Could be. Absolutely could be. Well, she arrives just in time to have Ai Wei say, "Nope, absolutely nobody followed me here. 100%. Nobody knows I'm here." And then Zaheer basically turns around and Korra's there. So Zaheer tosses Ai Wei's spirit into the Fog of Lost Souls. And now he, as we mentioned earlier, is doomed to die a physical death of starvation and rotting. So that is lovely. But then Zaheer and Korra basically sit down and have a conversation. So Mitch, you had a question of why Zaheer didn't just like toss Korra into the Fog of Lost Souls.
Well, I know. but I
still don't think that he wants to necessarily kill her. I think that they want to control her. And if she's in the Fog of Lost Souls, he can't control her. She's like dead.
Right.
There's no other newbies here, so I guess I can't speculate. I'll just throw that out into the void.
Did you say that on purpose?
Yeah, I mean, I think the conversation that they have definitely implies that Zaheer has a stronger plan than just throwing Korra into the Fog of Lost Souls. Like, there's more orchestration there than just this. And also, she would probably put up a much bigger fight than Ai Wei would. I mean, he might still win, because he's all, like, spiritual fanboyish. But I don't think it would be as easy as just him. And also, you know, Korra had not been in the Fog of Lost Souls, right? No, that was the other people.
Isn't that weird, meanwhile, too, that he's able to just kind of, like, apparate and disapparate while holding on to him? Like, this is so Harry Potter. The fact that he's able to just grab him and bring him somewhere else. It feels like Ai Wei doesn't even try and fight it, though. Like, he's just like, okay, this is my end. Like, if Zaheer's going for me, I'm done.
I thought he was just like, what? Like, what is happening? You know, because he thought he was on his side, you know? He was, like, Red Lotus, I guess. So I don't think he saw this coming. But then Korra and Zaheer have an amazing conversation that is basically, like, the two of them. Like, Korra, you know, basically, it's a huge info dump, but it also is, I think, really well done. There's a lot of tension there, and a lot of Korra kind of realizing exactly who she's up against and why. And I just really dig that conversation. Caitlin, how did you feel about it?
I think it was handled well, and it's intriguing to see that there are more secret societies. Earlier in the season, Natalie asked us for one word hints about what was to come, and I said red, and this is why, Red Lotus. So here's your payoff for that. But it's interesting to think about these secret societies and how they evolve and change with the time. And then it even ties back into book two with Unalaq and all that stuff, it's like, wow, all of this really does tie very well together. And it's neater than you expect it to be.
Isn't that so cool? I love that plot point.
Yeah, it is.
That Unalaq was part of the Red Lotus since way back when. And it's like, it feels almost like he's like the bad guy that just will not die. Like his ideology will survive him. He's almost kind of like the bad guy Jigsaw in the Saw series. Like his ideologies will always follow him because he makes such a big impact on this world of Korra. I love it. I love a good bad guy that can really like dig down into your psyche. And then you're like, oh gosh, maybe they were right. Because I mean, we have another moment here where Korra's like, you know, told, even you agree with him that you should, that the spirit portal should have been opened. Your own avatar Juan was wrong. And she doesn't even really answer that, but I wish she did. Cause we always ask her on this podcast, like, Korra, do you think your uncle was right? Why did you kill him then? But he was just kind of crazy. He wanted to be a dark avatar. No one really knows why that happened. Do we have an explanation for like what he was doing there then? Like, what was his ultimate goal? Just power?
I think he was super power hungry and I don't know. He was a weird character. But yeah, he was part of this too. He was part of the Red Lotus. Just in case we didn't know how bad he was, he was also part of the Red Lotus.
Right. And he backstabbed the Red Lotus. So yeah, he's like double, triple, quadruple bad.
Yeah. And I mean, something that's interesting is that he, Zaheer, I mean, like you said, Mitch, he really makes some, I wouldn't say that they're compelling arguments, but I think they are intelligent arguments and they are designed to confuse Korra. I don't think he's trying to convince her of his ideology, even though he says he is. I think he's playing for time, obviously, as we find out. And he does that very successfully, but he's, you know, like he's very upfront about what he wants. You know, the natural order is disorder, you know, chaos needs to exist. You know, he's kind of, I don't know, it's really almost like it's odd to hear this stated so baldly after, you know, going through all of Avatar and it was like balance, 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 balance. Mm-hmm. You know, everything needs to be in balance. And now he's like, nope, balance is terrible. Balance is the opposite of what is going to bring, you know, bring the good to the world. And stating that with such confidence, I found it really powerful. Ariana, do you have any thoughts on the Korra is kind of schooling by Zaheer?
I do think it's very interesting that he's bringing up some points that I think we brought up originally when we were like, no, you can't tear apart Rava and whatever the guy is, the bad
Batu.
Spirit. Batu, yeah, because we were like, no, now you're upsetting the balance. Like, the balance is that we have to have good and evil, not just one side dominating.
And it's interesting,
so
too,
I thought that was interesting.
With Rava and Batu being attached, that's a sort of, quote, balance that is also chaos. So I feel like there's a place for both that Zaheer, maybe he doesn't admit to in this conversation, but he would be forced to admit to. Because, like, if he thinks that splitting them was a mistake, but he likes chaos, you know, it just seems like... I really don't think, for instance, Zaheer, like, was cool with wanting to release Batu from that tree. I don't think that's the kind of chaos he wants. I think he wants the chaos of good and bad battling evilly, equally, I should say.
I also think it's really interesting how, even as pro-chaos as these people are, they're so, like, disciplined. Mm-hmm. Like, you know?
Well, you kind of have to be.
They aren't chaotic themselves.
Because if they're chaotic, they wouldn't get anywhere. They have to be really well-trained and, like, well-oiled machine. They have to know exactly what to do, how to get through and whatever.
They're kind of like in the like the D&D layout. They're not chaotic neutral because they're bad, but they're kind of neutral chaotic, if that makes any sense. That's just kind of occurred to me. But yeah, I mean, I think they're also talking about, you know, Zaheer is also definitely talking about freedom, you know, and he believes that that's how you achieve true freedom, that there is no governing principle. And like, so he can choose to be super disciplined, but that's his choice, you know? And yeah, I mean, obviously he's not a fan of government. The things he talks about, I think, especially, you know, with our modern, like the way modern society is, I think fit very interestingly into that. But so meanwhile, back in the actual world, things are going down because Zaheer turns out to not be like totally, like he can talk with his physical body when he's like in the real world. So he tells Minghua and Gazan where to find Korra, which just so happens to be the Misty Palms Oasis. So shit really goes down, and Minghua and Gazan attack them, and Korra is saved by Asami. On Naga, Minghua basically, I mean, it's not like, you know, they,
I mean, so she totally basically schools gets, them.
Yeah. I mean, she's playing with them. It's not hard for her. This isn't an issue, you know?
This was, I thought it was really interesting here to note, like, how, so Aang's friends were, like, the best benders, like, ever of all time. Right. And, like, Korra's friends are, like, they're kind of shitty benders. Like,
so, well, I mean, they are good benders, but they're also, you know, I think it's actually worth thinking about the fact that most of their training comes from pro bending, you know, right. Whereas Aang and the gang, they were literally fighting a war. So, that's a difference there. But definitely, you know, Minghua and Gazan are just on a completely different level. Was there any doubt that Mako and Bolin were going to wind up captured in this scene for anybody? Ariana?
I mean, I kind of thought they were going to get away. I thought they would get Korra and Asami, and these two guys would get away. But no, they just got everybody. Everybody got caught.
Well, somebody got everybody. Yeah. Yeah, any other, Mitch or Caitlin, any thoughts on this fight?
Well, yeah, even, like, to the effect of who's a better bender in each group, the gang or the crew, I think it makes more sense, too, that, yeah, I know the Fire Ferret brothers were just basically trained.
The gang.
They were, the Fire Ferret brothers were just kind of trained in their pro bending arena, but then we also had, you know, Katara starting underneath Paku and, you know, I guess even Hama for that sake, and a bunch of other awesome waterbenders along the way. The waterbending scrolls helped her out. And then, you know, Aang had the benefit of all that. And then Toph was fighting against people like quadruple her size. Like, they had almost nothing to do but to train how to, like, you know, fight everyone that
but they
is,
were actually, yeah.
Like, because they have more of a reason ever. To. But I think, yeah, I guess that the point of, like, the not being in a war makes a big difference because it's like, okay. Well, I think their training comes within this series because, like, we're already starting to see some improvements in Bolin and Mako in particular from the beginning of the series until now in their abilities to fight and dodge and do a lot. And I think that comes from losing sometimes. So, that's the most I'll say there.
I mean, also, Minghua and Gazan were such big threats that they had to be locked away in specifically designed prisons on mm-hmm. the four corners of the earth to keep them from using their bending to escape. So, I mean, in book one, Aman, like, compliments Mako for, like, being a great bender. So I don't think it's so much the they're not good benders, but that's just the level of the threat that they're facing is so beyond anything that they could understand.
Right. Agreed. I love when Aman compliments Mako there. It makes me feel really happy that I'm surprised. I'm not hating Mako as much as I used to. Maybe it's because he's just staying out of the romance.
Oh, no. I found Mako so endearing in this episode. I mean, I love how he had, like, a stakeout logbook, and he's just so grumpy, and, like, his grumpiness is really endearing to me now.
Yeah,
he's found his calling as a cop. He's a good cop.
And I agree it's kind of random.
Grumpy Mako is a good look for him.
Because Natalie often says, like, it's very random that he decided to pick up being a cop, and I agree. But it makes sense now that you see it in action.
Yeah, now it is.
It's so good. I love when even, I don't know if anyone has this line, but when
yes, that's my line. That's okay, my line, yes. I'm pretty sure.
I was scrolling really quick. I was like, oh no.
Yeah. So me and then by the way, sidebar, Korra and Korra and Asami are also captured by some people. And Korra is like put in like a Hannibal Lecter type getup.
McCall, yeah. Do you remember how we felt?
Like,
Do you remember how we felt when that first happened? Like, we saw that that was coming in the next episode on the preview, and you and I were just like, the show really just did this. Like, this looks not even, like, PG. This is intense.
Yeah, it's all very, what is going on? Yeah, I mean, it's one of the, you know, I have a lot of thoughts, but they're also, like, these episodes really start to flow into each other at this point. Yeah. And it's important to see what comes next. I'll just say that.
What do you think about Ariana? Is this, like, was it a shocking thing to see her in that getup?
Oh, I didn't even pay attention to that. My favorite thing in this episode was Asami's face when, like, Cora wakes up and she's, like, I don't even remember what she said, but she's, like, what's going on? And Asami is just, like, ugh. Well, we got caught. Like, Asami says all the time, she's like, I have to do everything myself, don't I, guys?
Like, oh, you don't even know. Oh my god, you're gonna love the next episode, Ariana.
I'm so excited to hear your reactions to it.
Yeah. Oh, the next episode's so good. Mm-hmm. It's funny that, like, if you think about it, these two episodes, I mean, most of these episodes are paired, but I think these two work really interestingly together. Like, at the beginning it's like, oh, okay, we're safe in Zaufu, and then there's this attack, but then we shake that off, and then we kind of, you know, we flow into this episode, and it's like, you know, you think you're safe, and then it ends up with the second attack and everybody's captured. So it's, I really like the way that's kind of all bookended. Any other thoughts on this episode before we move on to favorite scenes and lines?
Well, Caitlin, we should thank that one listener. Do you remember their name that wrote in that email about how we should go about doing these 13 episodes?
I don't have it off the top of my head.
Oh, I don't remember who that was either, but thank you, listener.
Shout out to you. You know who you are. Because there's one person that wrote in that we should have done, 307 on its own, so that we could pair the rest of these together better.
Correct.
Cool, cool. All right, so favorite lines. Mitchell, go ahead.
Favorite scenes.
Favorite scenes, yeah. That one.
My favorite scene was Minghua getting up close and personal with Mako. It was so cat and mouse, and it was just, there was a little bit of an innuendo there, like the way she gave him that smile, like, hey, sexy boy, you know? It was
very Azula and Zuko.
It was, well, it should be Azula, think about it, right? Same voice actress.
Yes!
I love it so much.
Ariana, how about you?
Mine was definitely when Cora did the Sokka Katara Water Tribe throwback. I was so excited. I was like, that's right, Water Tribe!
And don't they have wanted posters in that bar, too? In the Atla scene? I think they did.
No, that wasn't a bar. That was, like, after the battle, I think, with that one, the sexy lady with the dragon, with the...
Was it?
Who rode that animal. Yeah, and Katara's like, peace. Yeah, I think that was it. After they, like, won a battle, and they were like, peace out.
Leaving. Caitlin, what was your favorite scene?
So mine was Mitch's least favorite part, was Asami kicking Bolin's butt at Pie Show. And I love Bolin. He's like, it's going to be a pie showdown. Like, I just love that entire interaction. It's so great. He's like, I'm going to kick her butt. And then Asami just, like, destroys him, and it's amazing.
Yep, agreed. And my favorite scene was the tense showdown with Zaheer in Zhai Bao's grove, because it was Zhai Bao's something, whatever it was, wherever that happened. I really, really enjoyed that. As I expressed at length earlier, Mitchell, what was your favorite line?
All right, so my favorite line was Bolin. I thought stakeouts were supposed to be exciting. This isn't at all. Preach, Bolin, preach.
Ariana?
Mine comes right after yours, so I think you should do yours first.
Okay. So, Caitlin, yours is actually connected, so go ahead.
Okay. So mine was during the stakeout, and they're looking at the rule book and realizing, oh, there's like a gazillion ways to play a Pie Show, and Bolin's like, Cora, as the Avatar, you need to standardize these Pie Show rules. And Cora's like, okay, I'll put that on my to-do list right after bring back the Air Nation and taking down the group that tried to kidnap me. And Bolin's just like, that's cool, whenever you get to it. Just like completely missing the point. It's so great.
That's really cute. You know what? Actually, Caitlin, this reminds me of how you and I would talk. Like, I would be Bolin and you'd be Cora.
Mitch is always missing the point.
Caitlin, can you, like, fix these Pie Show rules? Sure, Mitch. I'll get right after that. I have to, you know, go fix who's trying to murder me first.
I also like that this is kind of, I don't know, I feel like this is a little bit meta, where, like, you know, Mike and Brian saying to, like, the fans, like, play Peugeot however you want. We're not going to write a rule book for you.
Mm-hmm.
So my favorite line was Boleyn.
They wrote a rule book. No, there is a rule book.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm wrong.
Yes,
you found one?
There is a rule book because... No, okay, because I'm watching the Amazon Prime, like, 5 minute, like, after the show is over.
Oh, yeah.
For this one, so Nickelodeon wanted to make a Peugeot game online, so they made, like, they got game designers to, like, make rules for it, so then for, then Mike and Brian, whenever they use it on the show, they have to follow, like, those rules, so they, like, shot themselves in the foot, so they had to figure out how to play. So, yeah, so they're really playing Peugeot in the game.
It's like they're Quidditch, like, they hate writing episode. About it.
Cool. All right. So my favorite line comes from when, you know, they're donning their new identities, and Boleyn's like, I'm an ex-United Forces operative named Ting Ting. War was the only woman I loved until Ivy came along and showed me what real love is. Tragically, she was taken from me by my arch enemy, Dr. Razor, and he, you know, and then Mako interrupts, because I just love, whenever Boleyn gets enthusiastic.
Let's just find Iwei. And he yes. So then, so Mako's like, let's just find Iwei. And then Boleyn is like, but I haven't even told you your backstory. And Mako goes, I'm a cop. I don't need a backstory. And Boleyn's like, ooh, you're good at this.
And both of those things are true.
What a cute shout-out to that.
All right, cool. So we're going to move on to our listener feedback, which we have quite a bit, as usual. You guys are cool. Like, you write to us. That's so weird. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can contact us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can leave a message on this post on hypeable.com. Play with us on Tumblr and leave us an iTunes review. If you rate us 5 stars, then Caitlin will make you a slightly creepy doll representation of your half-naked movie star likeness.
I like that one.
I get pulled into this.
I like it.
Are you a crafter, Caitlin? I didn't even check for iTunes reviews this week. Crap. I wonder if anyone...
Remotely a crafter.
Are you good at sewing, Caitlin? Could you do this?
No, I really couldn't.
Oh, well, we can pretend.
So it would be probably more than slightly creepy.
Cool. All right. So from Twitter, we have Kate Louise 2, who says, I would love a Hypeable Broadway podcast. Please, please, please. Oh my God, that would be insane. Mitch, you want to take the next one?
Sure. This comes from at Shelley Bookworm, who wrote, finally convinced my fiance to start Core, so I'm actually rewatching now. Wonder if we'll manage to catch up. I have to say, every time I rewatch the show, I always feel like I'm watching it for the first time, because there's always so much intricacy that I don't remember, and it makes me so happy. I love it so much. I'm happy that you can enjoy that with your fiance, Shelley. Enjoy.
Ariana, you want to take the email?
Yes. So this email from Caroline on... It was on the topic of whether or not the Avatar is really needed. And she said, does the world really need an Avatar if roughly 1/3 of their lifespan is spent otherwise engaged, being a baby and or training to be a proper Avatar? Does it not seem as though the world more or less tends to balance itself? Well, in real life, yeah. Hopefully. But I like having an Avatar. It's why we have a show.
Well, I have to say that Carolyn wrote in, like, a lot more detail in case any of us...
Yeah, so she's probably like, dumbasses, you aren't even reading my email right. Sorry, Caroline, this is what Mitch gave us.
No. I just try to condense it, because there was, as usual, there's always so much good that I thought that this is, like, an interesting conversation piece, because, I mean, I never thought about it before Caroline brought it up. Like, yeah, there's a good chunk of, like, oh, I don't know, like, arguably, like, what, 15 years when there's nothing going on? The only part I don't agree with is that 1/3 doesn't make sense, because it seems that the Avatar seems to live to, like, 160, and that Aang used up 100 of his years in his iceberg, so that's why he only lives to be, like, 65. So, I don't know if it really feels like to anyone that there's such a large gap, because they're really going to be, you know, alive and well, like a Dumbledore, for like hundreds, it feels like hundreds of years, I'm sure. They last generations.
I also don't agree that the world balances itself, because when the Avatar comes of age, it's almost always like, well, shit's going down. you got access now. Congratulations. So I do feel that, you know, I think that politically the Avatar is in a weird position. And I think that's definitely focused on in season one and two, with Korra being this, you know, 17-year-old with huge political and physical power, albeit very ambiguous political power. But I think that it's still needed in this world, for sure. Caitlin, any thoughts?
I mean, I agree. Like, if we... Like, there are things that happen that literally no one else could deal with, like harmonic convergence. Like, who else is going to deal with that? And so there are things that seem to crop up that are going to throw balance into whack. That so even if... But they do seem to happen when the Avatar has come of age, which is convenient. So if something like that popped up when the Avatar is like 6, we would be having a lot more problems.
Well, we have to also note that there was a large period of time where civilization obviously existed with Wands, you know, becoming the first Avatar, that there was not an Avatar at all. And everyone seemed to be doing just fine, I guess, right?
Well, for 100 years, they didn't have an Avatar, too, with right. Aang and the iceberg.
But the world almost ended because...
And that went really
yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's true.
Because Ozai, like, yeah. Well, you know, you can't win them all.
The thing is, though, if like, part of the matter is that they're used to having an Avatar, right? So that mm-hmm. they're used to having that check on evil and things like that. So part of the reason why the Fire Nation wanted to get rid of the Avatar was so that they could take advantage of that, you know? I think, you know, if this was a new thing, it might not make as much sense, and people might be like, oh, no, the world does take care of itself, but they're used to the world not taking care of itself, so... Sort of a cycle in that way. Caitlin, you wanna read Daniel Stewart's sad little comment from My Bubble?
Yeah. So in response to the last episode, Daniel says, "She ate the bear." The Earth Queen ate the poor bear. It was really upsetting.
Oh, the just a bear. Oh.
That bear must have lived for a long time in order for her to be able to eat it.
Yeah, she must have been really, really vindictive about that damn bear. I mean, like, yeah.
It was too old that it couldn't even try to be a threat.
Just didn't like it.
Like, you're old, so I will eat you. That's horrific, actually. Like, eating a pet? Wow. I really don't like her.
Yeah, I don't think we're supposed to like the Earth. Stay tuned. Anyway, so yeah, our last comment comes from Lauren on Hypeable, who wants to talk about...
I'll take this one because this was the most frustrating thing to listen to on last week's discussion, but I will take this one.
All right.
Okay. So Lauren says, in regards to the whole Pema and Tenzin age gap, Tenzin is officially 51 years old at the start of book one, and Pema is officially 35 years old. If my math is correct, Tenzin would be around 16 years old when Pema was born. Usually in television or movies, a couple is only a few years apart or the same age. Then again, Hollywood is famous for having us turn the other cheek. Example, Jim Carrey was around 45 in Yes Man, and Zooey Deschanel was around 27. Both of them are mature enough to pull off whatever the characters' ages were in the movie, but it was a bit distracting. Bottom line is, as long as you love someone and you're both of consenting age, it doesn't really matter. You and your partner love each other, and that's all that matters. Oh, nice podcast, by the way. Okay, first thing. Yes, Hollywood is famous for this, but you would never see, like, a 60-year-old woman and a 40-year-old man. It's always, like, the other way around. It's always the young girl with, you know, Jim Carrey. But secondly, okay... We have said this multiple times, guys. If you guys listen to the other podcasts, maybe you'd remember. But yes, Tenzin is 16 years older than Pema. They were She was approximately in her early 20s. He was in his like late 30s when he broke up with Lin to go with Pema. And the reason that Natalie and I said it was creepy was because Pema was his student, and that's a little weird. Because he was like her. It was like a very college professor student thing. Going on. That's why we said it was a little weird at first.
Well, I don't know if I should share this on Rewatchable, but one of my great uncles married a high school student that he taught. So.
Well, that was a different day. I don't really have.
Yeah, that was a different day. It wasn't that different. I mean, also, he wasn't like that much older. He was, you know, he was a young teacher, but it was a bit of a scandal when it happened. And they've been married for, like, I don't know, 40 years now, so... Yeah, I don't know.
Obviously, it worked out really well for Tenzin and Pema.
But obviously, since I'm Team Lynn, I feel like she's like one of my girlfriends, and it's like, yeah, let's hate on her, Lynn. You're so right. You're so much better than her. But I mean, I do think it's a little creepy that, you know, he was like, 38 and with this 22-year-old, or he left Lynn for this 22-year-old. Who was like,
yeah. Yeah, like, wasn't Lynn suspicious? Do you think that she had like this, like, I think that's part of why she still has so much rage against Tenzin, because she's just like of all the people you could have left me for, it was her. Like, and it doesn't even feel like he broke up with her. He broke up with her to be with Pema. It's always been my interpretation.
Hang on, I'm confused. Do we know for sure that Lynn was broken up with because of Pema?
Yes.
No. Do we?
Oh, yes. He left her for Pema. That's what she talks about in the first season. She's like, yeah, she stole him. She's like, yeah, I stole him.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why. And he broke up with Pema. He, like, didn't break up with her. He, like, left her for Pema. And that's why Lynn was, like, that shit crazy mad, because he dumped her for this hot young piece of ass.
You can imagine how difficult... Yeah. You can imagine how difficult it would be for Lynn to, like, allow anyone else into her heart after that. That's why she's so steely gray, because she got screwed over majorly. Like, she wanted those air babies. She wanted to be important.
Everybody. No, I don't think she wanted air babies. I mean, I'm sure that's why they broke up, because she was, like, too focused on her job.
And he was like, but we need kids. And she's like, Tenzin, I just can't. I need to follow my mom's legacy. We'll follow her legacy by having kids.
And she's like, my mom doesn't even love me.
When the show was on, there was like the whole theory that Lynn was infertile, and that was why they broke up. I don't really.
We think that Toph was born blind, or we know that, I'm sure, by now. Is there a chance that genetically she would be afraid to have blind children?
I don't think she would be afraid of that at all. Toph turned out just fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If she had bending, though, that's the thing. I think bending helps you out a lot more.
There's a lot of blind people who do really cool shit. Helen Keller couldn't see or hear, and she, like, traveled the world.
Very true.
Yeah. I feel like we're still going to be arguing about Tenzin, Pema, and Lynn in, like, the finale, and we're going to see, like, the crazy stuff that goes down in the finale, and it's going to be like, yes, but how do we feel about Pema? Anyway, assuming Pema survives it that long. Okay, so thank you so much for listening to this episode of Rewatchable. We'll be back next week with Long Live the Queen and the Ultimatum, which, if you've seen season 3 before, you know are frickin', yeah, those episodes. Anyway.
I'm excited!
Oh my god, Ariana.
What's a theory you have?
Okay, well, I'm really excited that now that, people are separated in the way that they separated, that perhaps maybe the thing might be coming into it. So that's what I'm excited for.
You're funny. I like the way you think. What about the episode titles? What did they make you think?
Oh, I didn't really look at them because I was so excited last week that I watched these two last week since I knew I wasn't going to be on. So now it's been like 2 weeks and I don't remember.
Well, McCall just said them. Do you want to hear it again?
What is it?
It's Long Live the Queen and the Ultimatum.
Oh my gosh, the Ultimatum. I bet that the Red Lotus is going to be like, we're going to kill everybody unless you give it, like, you come with us, Korra. And then she comes with them, and it's like an arrow where he has to do, where, like, his sister's going to die or whatever. You know what I'm talking about? Like, where, unless he becomes, like, slayed. But then it's fine because Korra's going to do, like, a switch up on them and, like, in the end, it'll be fine. She'll betray them and be back to good.
Just you wait.
I really want an evil avatar, guys.
That's you what I had really... one for like a hot second. Nevatu was still.
I did, but I want like a real one that is cool. That one was just crazy.
Yeah.
Can I just assert my? This is way back, and we gotta go, but. I'm still annoyed that they called him Unavatu when clearly it should be Vatunalak. But yeah.
That's cute.
I mean,
well, I'm kind of glad we got rid of that Q because that Q is just pesky.
I hear that. All right. Well, thank you guys so much. Come back next week for more madness and craziness. My name is Michal.
I'm Mitch.
I'm Ariana.
And I'm Caitlin.
Flameo, hot people.
Flameo, hotman. Bye bye.